Now you get the secret teachings. So one way of exploring and developing this quality of equanimity is to really understand what are called the three marks of existence. So that is this insight into impermanence, this recognition of the conditioned nature of all phenomena, what is sometimes called selflessness, and the third of these three characteristics is the truth of suffering, the truth of dukkha. So, recognizing and deepening our understanding, our embodied understanding of these three characteristics, awakens both compassion and equanimity, and really a sense of the way in which our actions have certain results, and we are experiencing in this moment the results of previous actions. So this is this view and understanding of the karmic links. And also at times recognizing that karma is vast and that we see people suffering and we have no idea why. And you know, a friend of mine who died of cancer when he was 43, he had two sons. And he asked himself, what did I do wrong? Well, there's, you know, this unfolding of karma and conditioned phenomena. We don't know. We don't really know. But what we do know is that the ways in which we respond skillfully to the present moment are planting seeds in our own stream of karmic actions and results. So we are completely capable and have great potential for generating a happy future. I mean, I say that and I recognize, you know, we have so many aspects of our lives over which we have no control. But the one aspect we do have some measure of control over is our ability to relate skillfully in a wholesome way, with wisdom, with compassion, with kindness. And that's why it's so wonderful that you stayed on to the very end of this retreat, because it shows your own commitment to your own happiness, your commitment to living a wholesome life. So a few years ago, I attended a book launch in Vancouver. It was held at the Mountain Rain Center, beautiful little Zen center in Vancouver. And I don't think I brought the book, but the book that was being launched is called Hidden Lamp, 25 Centuries of Awakened Women. This beautiful collection of short stories about women in different Buddhist traditions, and then a commentary by current women meditation teachers. So really a beautiful collection. So the two editors were present, and they spoke about how the book came into being over several years. They assembled translations and retellings of anecdotes and stories. And after selecting 100 stories, they wrote to many different women Dharma teachers and asked them to write a reflection. So that includes, I think, perhaps Adrienne Ross is in there, and Christina Feldman, different teachers we know. And they ask them to demonstrate the way in which these anecdotes and stories were like koans. So a koan in Zen tradition is like a riddle that you keep meeting it at different moments, and gradually the riddle breaks open and illuminates some aspect of practice and of the teachings. So very interesting to read how some of these teachers responded to the stories. So there were three stories that were read out at the event. And what amazed me that evening, and I think this is part of the storyteller in me, is that I'm always interested in how stories call to other stories. So you hear a story, and it resonates with you. And you think, oh yeah, that reminds me, or that inspires me, or that makes me think of something. And I think it's so important to honor those moments of resonance. So what was wonderful in this evening is that three stories were from the collection were shared, and people were given space to respond. And towards the end of the evening, there was a young woman sitting in the back, and she spoke about her own struggle with her perception that Zen practice demands complete acceptance and equanimity. And the story that she was responding to, I'll just retell very briefly, was called Setsujo Weeps. Setsujo Weeps. And the story of a great woman teacher in the Zen tradition whose granddaughter died. And one of her students came to her and said, "Why are you weeping? You're a great teacher. What are people going to think? You have attachment. Why are you weeping?" And she said, "I am doing more for my grandchild than all the incense and bowing and prayers and meditation. I am weeping." So this was the story, said Sujo, and one of the Zen teachers responds to it in the commentary. But this woman who resonated with this short anecdote, she said, she struggled with the perception that Zen practice required of her that she be completely accepting and equanimous no matter her life circumstances. And she told us that she was working on a degree, a master's in neuroscience, because she has Huntington's disease and it runs in her family. And usually this disease on the onset is around age 40. And she has been told that she herself is a carrier. So imagine the implications if she's already had children or if she's thinking of having children. So she told us that she had been scouring the internet for stories written by others whose families were affected by the disease. And she admitted that she was searching for at least one example of a story with a happy ending. She was hoping for at least some story out there to encourage her to meet her own life circumstance. And she had to admit that really there were no stories, because there are no happy endings at this point for those who have Huntington's disease. So she asked the two editors, the writers of the book, Florence and Sue Moon, and Kate McCandless, the resident teacher at the center, how they would respond to that. She said, "Zen tells me to be equanimous, to be accepting, and this is my life circumstance." Setsujo wept for her granddaughter. Am I supposed to be without any response to the facts of my own life. And it was so beautiful to hear how they responded. They reminded her that no stories have any happy endings in any definitive or permanent sense. You think about all the fairy tales we read and heard as children, and they lived happily ever after. But did they? Did they never argue? Did, you know, they have no children who were born with a serious illness? Did they have no calamities or floods or fires? I mean, really, a way that a story could end is, and they lived learning how to be with the changing conditions of their lives. So in their response, they reminded her that stories simply illuminate episodes in a person's life, revealing how the individual grows and matures through their experience. And they asked her, in reading all the accounts that you found on the internet, were they helpful to her? Comforting, even though there were no happy endings. And she admitted that yes, they were, because she didn't feel so alone. And so they said to this young woman that if she were to write down her own reflections, if she were to craft her own memoir at whatever age she's at, even an essay describing her fears and longings, that in fact it could be of great benefit to others. And so we think about one of the gifts of the internet is that you can search any topic and find, you know, many, many people sharing their experience. And even often on those websites, opportunities for people to place their own comments and reflections. And then they reminded her that as students of the Buddha's teachings, we are not asked to transcend the very real suffering that we experience, but to bring a compassionate and loving attention to it. Investigating on deeper and deeper levels how any experience of gain or loss, fame or disrepute, pleasure or pain, success or failure, is simply teaching us once more the truth of impermanence, the truth of the unsatisfactory, this dukkha element. And they're also teaching us that everything arises due to conditions. Everything arises, has a duration, and passes away. And nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as me or mine. So, I didn't speak with her at the end of the evening, but it seemed to me that she received this offering and was open to it. And I recognized in myself a desire to know the outcome of her story. And I saw the arising of that desire, and then I recognized that I probably won't. But that's okay, that there is a way in which her experience in that evening illuminated something for me about the truth that all beings encounter suffering, and we're not asked to transcend the human experience of loss or grief. We're simply asked to recognize it as part of our journey, open to it, learn from it, let it soften our hearts towards ourselves and towards others. I think this is the beauty of the two wings of awakening, of wisdom and compassion, is that as we deepen our insight and our understanding of impermanence, of selflessness, and of the truth of suffering, we also recognize that this is a universal experience for all beings. And that in itself awakens great compassion. So, my French teacher, Maggie Duchenne, very influential person in my life who taught me the power of story. She shared with me the memory of the last time she saw her father. So let's go back in time. It's about 1949. It was a few days before her 14th birthday. And she had been sent off to boarding school against her wishes. She loved the village where she lived on a farm with her family. And at a certain age, her parents just shipped her off to boarding school because that's what you did in those days. And her family had come through the Second World War. Her father was the mayor in this little village. And her older brother, her two older brothers had participated in the resistance, and shortly before the end of the war, her brother Henri was killed. And her family had known a lot of challenges in that time, but she was very close to her father. So she came home for the weekend, and her mother had prepared this special birthday dinner. And she had many brothers and one sister, and they all had gathered. And there was a family tradition in her household that whosever birthday it was would be allowed to have a tête-à-tête with Papa. So all the other siblings went out of the room, and for a few moments Maggie had her father to herself. And he asked her about her school and how she was getting on, and they just had a very lovely, sweet moment together. So 2 days later, she was back at school, and she was called into the principal's office and told that her father had died. And he'd had, you know, illness, and mostly induced by stress, I'm sure. But it was unexpected nonetheless. So this experience of losing her father at that age had stayed with her all her life. But the timing of his death had highlighted for her a great gift, which was her father's way of reflecting to his children, of taking time with them, of encouraging them, inquiring into their lives, and mirroring to them their particular unique talents and gifts, their potential. So I was a student teacher in Maggie's class when I was in my 20s. And Maggie had embodied this gift that she received from her father. And she knew each of her students, and she would say, "Oh, Sophie, la danseuse, oh, Jacob, inventeur." And she would mirror to them, not just once or twice, but it was the way that she drew them in and assigned different tasks to them in the classroom or organized for them to give a performance, but constantly reflecting to them who they could be, who they were growing into, and what they could give the world. So this is the beauty of recognizing the challenges, the losses, and the gifts in our lives, is the untangling of our wanting things to be otherwise, wishing it could have been otherwise, and opening to the way it is. Is there a gift in there? I guess it sounds a bit trivial, a bit trite, looking for the silver lining. But actually, the silver lining is already there if we come from the perspective of the Dharma, of this willingness to investigate, to understand, and to open to the truth, letting our lives be informed by ever-deepening wisdom into these three marks of existence, however we understand them. I mean, the truth of change, you know, change can be a relief as well as a burden. But this opening again and again, thinking about all the retreats you may have attended or that you may attend, and how they have a shape, you know, an idea is formed. Oh, let's host a retreat on these dates. Let's invite this teacher. Let's announce it to the community. And then you read it in a newsletter, you looked it up on a website, you marked it on your calendar, you registered, you came. The conditions appeared due to many people's efforts and your own efforts and your own motivation. For some people, one day was enough. Others came back for a second day. So it's sort of mysterious in a way how we step into this journey of our lives again and again. You know, we have our lists, we have our tasks, we have the things we want to accomplish. And then, you know, at the end of the day, is it possible just to open up to the truth of change? Oh, another day. Another day. Sometimes lying in the bed in the morning, I think, I don't really want to get up. And yet, you know, there's so much that pulls us into our lives. Even the most pleasant experience, our enjoyment of it can only be sustained for a certain amount of time. Usually one cookie is enough, you know? Well, maybe two. Or if they're small, you know? Anyway. So, these are the eight winds, you know, the eight winds of fortune. And Christina Feldman refers to them. Our moments of fame and disgrace, those we love or hate, the pleasure and the pain, the gains and the losses, none of them are graspable. All are held in the embrace of impermanence. So not understanding this deeply, we can become lost in craving and aversion and in forgetfulness. Heroic efforts are made to keep, maintain, and possess that which is already passing, or to eradicate the things that are equally held in the clasp of change. In teaching impermanence, the Dalai Lama once instructed his students to reflect on all that has already disappeared. Already disappeared. The afflictions we thought would last forever, the people we have loved and lost, the identities and passions we assumed would be lifelong, all now are simply a memory. The thousands of thoughts we have had, the emotions we have struggled with, the dreams, all of them have changed. We could further reflect on what is disappearing right now and what will surely disappear in the future. Life flickers in the flurries of a thousand ills, more fragile than a bubble in a stream. In sleep, each breath departs and is again drawn in. How wondrous that we wake up living still. So that was Nagarjuna, the great Indian sage. Understanding impermanence, says Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, understanding impermanence is not a rejection of the things of this world, but an acceptance that they pass away. So, if we are to live this life with grace, we are asked to embrace not only beginnings, but also endings. So this is our practice of equanimity, is meeting the truth of change. So I just want to say a couple of words about about equanimity as one of the four divine abidings. So this, the divine abidings, these four divine abodes, and these are beautiful states of mind that we can cultivate. Loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And I think about how one of my teachers gave a beautiful example of how a parent, or parents might have four children, and maybe their youngest child is a gymnast and loves the physicality of their climbing and rolling and jumping and turning somersaults. And the parent sees this and wishes them well. You know, may you be happy in your exploration of this gift you have. Wishing them well. And perhaps another one of their four children is weak, was born not so great a constitution. And so the parent has this quivering of the heart before the child's vulnerability and says, I care about you, I care about your pain. May you be free from suffering. May you grow strong. So it's a different aspect. You know, may you be happy. May you be free from suffering. And then a third child is now leaving home and with confidence and clear sense of direction is embarking on their own life, studies and work and relationship. And the parent looks on and may your happiness never end. So this appreciative joy, mudita, this beautiful quality of mudita, sympathetic joy. And we can experience that ourselves with the blossoms, you know, with the trees changing. So the parent relates to that child with appreciation of their joy and taking real delight in their success. And then the fourth child has probably perhaps already left home, but is struggling perhaps and has some successes but some setbacks. You know, a relationship that didn't turn out, financial difficulties. And the parent has to really call up this equanimity. So not disassociating, not separating, not abandoning the relationship, but recognizing your happiness or unhappiness depend upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. I care about you, and I know that your happiness depends upon your actions, not upon my wishes for you. So, parent calling up equanimity, recognizing that for whatever reason, the conditions in their child's life have led them to where they are. And that doesn't mean that they don't offer suggestions. My dad, he loved to give me advice. But recognizing that they're on their own journey. So this is Ajahn Suchito. With equanimity, I can tune into where you're at, up or down, and that doesn't change my empathy with you. Further, it comes with an understanding that whatever you're going through right now will change, and I trust your capacity to pass through this phase. So in a sense, and I love the way that he frames this, equanimity is an offering of respect. And who among us hasn't wished that our parents would trust us to figure it out? I actually had to go to Africa to get away from my dad wanting to organize me. But it's so interesting. It's an offering of respect. With equanimity, we can allow ourselves and others to grow past views and perspectives to the point where we might wisely realize that everything that manifests as ourselves or as others is a passing show. With equanimity, there is no panic, no defense, no claiming, rejecting, blaming, worrying, doubting, or treasuring. He says, it's the tops. And the other thing that Ajahn Suchito says, which I really appreciate, is just to consider any projects that we're engaged in. So it may be, you know, a group that we're leading or a creative endeavor. And to really see how where are we focusing? Is it some kind of result that we're looking for that would affirm for us the value of the energy we've put into it? And he really recommends that we think about applying energy equally, calling up our energy for whatever projects involved, instead of just sort of placing all our hopes on the final result, to see that we can bring a measured, calm, and attentive energy to all the steps and all the stages of whatever endeavor, and actually to enjoy those steps. It's sort of like, you know, we want the kitchen counters to be clean, but can we enjoy the process of putting things away, tidying up? So this measured approach that really is evenness of mind, evenness and care and attention. So just one more story for you, and I was in a grade 4 or 5 classroom last week. I'll just wait till Rhonda comes in. And I've been really thinking about how to introduce mindfulness to children. And we've been doing a listening meditation, and we've been talking about looking and what do you notice. And then someone mentioned to me the neuroscientist Dan Siegel's new book called Aware, and how in that book he talks about how a tactile experience is more likely to stay in the memory than an auditory or visual experience. So, in thinking about that, and I took a bag of beautiful beach stones into this class of grade 4 or 5 students, and I had them reach into this cloth bag and feel for a stone. I said, "Choose the, take the first one you touch." But of course, you know, they were like, So they reached in and they pulled out the stone, and I said, "Don't look at it. Just see what you can discover by feeling it." And they really wanted, mine feels black once in, I think mine's white. So they began to, you know, I had them pass them from one hand to the other, and then to share what they noticed. And they noticed, oh, it was cool. It was smooth. It was bumpy. It had corners. It was rough. It was triangular. It was oval. They had little pockets or cracks or crevices. And then they opened up their hands and looked at the stone. And I said, "Now show them to your friends." And they were so excited they were showing them to their friends. And then someone said, "Can we keep them?" And I said, "Well..." So what I asked them to do is I said, "Let's bring them up one at a time." And I had a large sheet of paper, and I said, "Let's place them and make some collective art." And so they came up and they placed their stones together in one little clump and another little clump, and they looked and enjoyed the art, and so they were able to let go because they were contributing to something greater, I think. So this, I hoped, was an experience, and I just before they went outside, I said, "Now we've done mindful listening, we've done mindful looking, we've done mindful feeling." And then their teacher took them outside, and they came to see me at the art gallery a couple of days later. But there was one boy who didn't go outside. And he said to me, "Do you ever watch Czech TV?" I said, "No." "Have you heard of Andrew Revit?" And I said, "That's me." And he told me how he'd had a liver transplant last year. And I said, "Oh, how are you doing?" "You know, I'm getting better. I'm pretty good. But I don't go out and run when everybody else does." And, you know, just the willingness for him to share his experience with me was so lovely. So I hung out with him for a few moments, and I said, "Andrew, when you come to the gallery, I'm definitely going to remember your name, because now I know your story." So they came to the gallery, and interestingly, he was there with his parents. And they were, both his parents, both his dad and his mother were there with him. And at different points in the program in the gallery, he would be leaning against his dad or sitting close to his mother. And it was just so beautiful. And my heart went out to them. You know, imagine, you know, having a son who at the age of 9 or 10 needs a liver transplant. You know, I'm not a physician, and I don't know. But for that child to receive a liver transplant, another child had to die. So this amazing way in which Andrew's life is woven with the story of another child's death, and his parents' ability to nurture him and grow with him and celebrate him and his successes is woven with those other parents and their loss. And this, to me, just speaks of the amazing mystery of this human journey. And it really reminds me that when we take birth in human form, we really are so blessed to encounter these teachings, because they give us a way of understanding our lives, a way of living our lives, a way of honoring the stories of others' lives. So I just want to finish with a poem, another poem from this collection called A Book of Luminous Things. Pregnant pause. This is Raymond Carver, The Cobweb. A few minutes ago, I stepped out onto the deck of the house. From there, I could see and hear the water and everything that's happened to me all these years. It was hot and still. The tide was out. No birds sang. As I leaned against the railing, a cobweb touched my forehead. It caught in my hair. No one can blame me that I turned and went inside. There was no wind. The sea was dead calm. I hung the cobweb from the lampshade, where I watch it shudder now and then when my breath touches it. A fine thread, intricate. Before anyone realizes, I'll be gone from here. A fine thread, intricate. Before long, before anyone realizes, I'll be gone from here. So I'll just sit for a moment and let these words settle in. Savoring the stillness of the afternoon. So in this last few moments, before we break silence together and reflect on the day of practice, just extending this warmth of loving kindness to yourself. May I truly be safe and protected from inner and outer harm. May I be strong and healthy of body. May I be happy and peaceful of mind. May I take care of myself happily while living in this world. So tuning in to this unconditional friendliness. May I accept myself just as I am. May I love myself completely. May I honor the ups and downs, the twists and turns of the river of my life. May I be my own best friend. And now, tuning into any difficulties, any physical, mental, or emotional challenges we're having, offering compassion. I care about my pain. I care about my suffering. May I be free from suffering. And now tuning in to whatever is bringing us delight and enjoyment in our lives. Some project accomplished, some project begun, some new connection, some enjoyment of walking, cycling. Being with children, playing music, drawing. May I take delight in my life. May my happiness and success continue. And now holding all of these with evenness of mind, the ups and downs, the turns and twists, the obstacles, the habit patterns of grasping and clinging, of aversion and irritation. May I truly accept myself as I am. May I nurture patience. May I be at ease with these changing conditions. And may our practice truly be of benefit to all beings in all directions. Again, this is invitational, but it's worth exploring because the realm of speech is one that can trigger a lot of reactivity. And so it's good to practice in a structured way with others who've been on retreat with us. And the question I'm inviting you to reflect on is, how will you practice equanimity in the days that come and the days that lie ahead? And it could be something very small, like practicing equanimity with not having enough time to accomplish what you want to accomplish, or being patient with yourself or accepting of another. So just in a way, thinking about how our practice in this formal container of the retreat is now going to manifest in the world, in our lives. And this is a little way of making that bridge and that transition. So please just turning to someone near at hand, and you'll have, you know, three or four minutes each before we close for the day. So just turning to someone. Or if you don't feel like it, just remaining in silence. Just wrapping up, I mean, that sounds kind of harsh, just coming to close. And please do bow to your listening partner. Thank you for sharing. It is quite magical to share with other people at the end of a retreat because we're open and we're tender. So I want to thank you all for your practice, your courage, and your commitment. And I hope that this weekend has been of benefit to you and that you will continue your journey in mindfulness and meditation and explore these teachings. And as you know, there are so many resources out there for you, books and audio dharma, kinds of talks online. So just continue in your own way and maybe see if you can find a friend on the path who will be your Dharma buddy, who will encourage you to attend a retreat or come with you to a talk. So I'll hand it over to Louise and to Metta.